Welcome to the Iran podcast. I'm your host, Negar Mortazavi, journalist and political analyst based in Washington, D.C., and a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Today, we'll talk about the recent agreement between Tehran and Washington to swap prisoners and unblock frozen assets. And we'll also take a look at the Biden administration's overall policy towards Iran. My guest today is Stephen Miles. He's president of Win Without War, a progressive foreign policy organization here in Washington. Stephen has worked with Win Without War for over a decade, and previously he worked with the global campaigning organization AVAZ. He was executive director of the American Hellenic Council, and he's worked on multiple federal, state, and local electoral campaigns. Stephen, welcome to the Iran podcast.
Thanks, Negar. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Let's first talk about this deal that was recently sort of announced. It took the administration some time to confirm it, but what we know is that a number of Americans or Iranian Americans have been moved from prison in Iran to hotel rooms as the first step to a swap. Iran's around $6 billion of assets that had been frozen in South Korea would be released under conditions, moved to Qatar. And then on the American side, a number of Iranian nationals who are held in prison for sanctions violations will be released. Talk about how much you know about the making of this deal. It took quite some while. We've been hearing about a potential swap since over a year ago. And just how the administration arrived to this point today.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to talk about this. I mean, I think let's start with the basics, that this is good news. You know, Americans that have been wrongly detained in Iran are coming home, according to reports. Obviously, we have to caveat this is still in progress. We understand it may take weeks and things can fall apart. But any time that Americans who have been wrongfully detained are freed and come home, that's good news. As you mentioned, Iranians will reportedly get increased access to some of their frozen assets to buy food and medicine. Again, that's good news. Food and medicine for people in need is a good thing. Inevitably, this is a small deal, and that gets into kind of how this has come about, but it's good news. The administration has been working across multiple channels and multiple avenues on Iran policy. This is one of those avenues. Obviously, a lot of attention, a lot of discussion is about the nuclear portfolio. And that's been obviously earlier, that was a major focus of diplomatic efforts. Those talks have reportedly not been as active recently, although there's possibility of an uptick. And of course, there's other issues that the U.S. and Iran are concerned about in terms of Iranian proxies in the region, Iran's support for Russia and their war in Ukraine. You know, presidents have to be able to eat gum and walk at the same time. They have to chew gum and walk at the same time. There's multiple things going on at once. And by all accounts, they've been working on getting these wrongfully detained Americans released for quite some time. The president has made this a focus of his administration for Americans who are detained all over the world. And it's good to see that this has finally come to fruition with these individuals.
Mm-hmm. We'll talk about the bigger picture in a little bit, but let's talk about the criticism to this news. There are multiple Republican figures, former administration officials, lawmakers were criticizing the administration from multiple angles for doing this deal. Talk about some of the criticism and what do you think would be the response to those who are saying the administration shouldn't have done this?
Yeah, I mean, look, Republicans said when Donald Trump did deals like this that it made him the greatest president in American history. Now that Joe Biden's doing a similar thing, they're saying it makes him the worst. So I think we have to be honest that their issue is with who the president is, not what his policy is. There's a lot of bad faith arguments that are going on. We see that every time that these issues are discussed. Their criticism ultimately comes down to opposition to Joe Biden. It wouldn't matter what he did. He could pursue exactly the same policies as Donald Trump. And in this case, he's pursuing very similar policies to what Donald Trump did throughout his administration in terms of bringing wrongfully detained Americans home. Their criticisms would continue because at the end of the day, their criticisms are partisan politics. They have very little to do with what good policy is. So I'm not surprised to hear these criticisms. I don't think many people will put much stock in them. And I certainly don't think they're being made in good faith.
Mm-hmm. Let me specify a couple of critiques that I've also been hearing and asked in my interviews. One is that doing this will encourage more hostage taking on the Iranian side or even globally of taking more Americans. The other argument, which is sort of related, is that, oh, money is fungible. So even though these funds, which were Iranian funds, are going to be used solely for humanitarian purposes, then that would free up other funds and the Iranian state will be using other means for other expenses. Can you talk about these two sort of interconnected critiques?
Yeah, I mean, let's start with the first one, because I think there is a philosophical question and a theoretical question that folks have about what the best way to prevent wrongfully detaining individuals, hostage taking is. It's been a debate for as long as the practice has existed. This is not a new debate. These are not new criticisms. They've been criticisms made of Democrats when they took this kind of deal-making behavior, which criticism made of Republicans when they made this behavior. And there's a genuine question around how we stop this kind of behavior that states are engaged in. It's more complicated when governments do this than it is when, say, individual organizations do this, like a gang or something of that nature. And look, presidents have to make a decision, and they ultimately have to make not a theoretical decision about how to handle this, but a real personal decision about individuals who are being held in sometimes very, very difficult and unpleasant circumstances and whose lives may be at risk at some level. You know, I'm not surprised that presidents continue to make the decision to do everything they can to bring Americans home. Just like Donald Trump made that decision, Joe Biden is making that decision now. Again, I think there's a theoretical debate to be made, to be had about the larger picture. But if you want to make that criticism, and you particularly right now, you have to have made that criticism consistently, and then you can engage in that debate. If you're making that criticism now and you didn't make it previously when Republicans have engaged in the same behavior, it's not really valid criticism, and there's no point in engaging with it as if it is. Again, there's a debate to be had, but it really does get to the intention of the person who's making the criticism, whether or not we should have that debate. The second issue that you brought up is the money being fungible. And look, there's a reality that money is fungible, but this deal, according to reports, contains about as many restrictions and safeguards as you can have. It amounts to sanctions relief. Sanctions relief is something that's long been on the books for humanitarian purposes. It's something that our government has long considered is an appropriate use of sanctions relief to make sure that a country of nearly 90 million people continues to have access to food and medicine. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about giving Iran access to its own money, its own reserves, its own funds that have been held in South Korea, as you mentioned. We're talking about a very small amount of money in the scheme of Iran's national economy in terms of how much money they're bringing in on an annual basis from oil sales. You know, we're talking about a fraction of that. We're talking about less than 2% of Iran's GDP being freed up under the sanctions relief for food and medicine. So you can have that argument. And when you make it out and you just talk about the number completely out of context, you can make it sound big and scary. You can talk about things that you're doing. But when you put it in context, when you say we're talking about around $70 a person for people in Iran to have greater access to food and medicine. We're talking about less than 2% of Iran's GDP. We're talking about a small portion of Iran's annual revenue that they're getting right now from oil and gas sales. You begin to understand that this is a modest step to, again, provide some sanctions relief as part of this agreement. And at the end of the day, we know from report after report after report out of Iran that there is a real scarcity of access to these items. And there's lots of reasons for why that may be. But if we can help Iran, if we can help Iranians have greater access to food, have greater access to the medicines that they need, that's a good outcome.
So let's take a step back and look more at the policy of the administration over the past few years, essentially since the beginning of this admin towards Iran. I know your organization is a major foreign policy and progressive foreign policy advocacy organization here in Washington, and you've been advocating for more diplomatic engagement, more, as you said, access for Iranian or generate Iranians to reduce sort of the harm of economic sanctions and all of that. How do you assess the overall Iran policy of this administration? I know this deal, you're saying, is a good news to many, especially to those families, to those who've been advocating for more progressive and diplomatic solutions towards Iran. But how do you assess the overall policy of the administration towards Iran, also considering some of the promises or commitments that candidate Biden had made before he became president?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. Again, I mean, I think it's helpful to put this moment in time in context. You know, look, our organization, Women Without War, as the name would indicate, was founded in opposition to not just war in general, but a particular war, the Iraq War, a little over 20 years ago. And that was the issue we were focused on because of its devastation and how foolhardy of a policy was. When the Bush administration began talking about openly going to war with Iran towards the end of the second term of the Bush administration, that was when this work really came onto our radar and the push to really say, we need to avoid a disastrous war of choice with Iran, the way we had just seen the disaster of Iraq play out. That's how this issue came in. And from that time, what we've seen is essentially two different approaches to how the U.S. can engage with Iran. We've seen one that says, we need to apply maximum pressure. We need to just pressure. And ultimately, at the end of the day, move towards regime change. And most likely, regime change will require a war. We've seen a separate and different track that was exemplified by the choices the Obama administration ultimately made, which is to say, let's engage with a different mindset than we did with the Iraq War. Let's, instead of doing this pathway of pressure and conflict, let's see if we can resolve these conflicts at the negotiating table. Let's see if diplomacy can help us navigate these issues. Ultimately, that most successfully culminated in the JCPOA, the Iran Nuclear Agreement. But during that second term of the Obama administration, that agreement takes a lot of the headlines, but there was other efforts at diplomatic engagement. There was more deconflicting that was going on, and really things were heading in a very different direction. Obviously, that all went out the window when Donald Trump came into office and we saw the return of pressure, the return of conflict. We saw dramatic escalation. We saw the U.S. brought to the brink of war with Iran multiple times during the Trump administration, including the exchanging of fire after the Soleimani assassination and Iranian attacks on U.S. Positions in Iraq. And so we've seen these two different approaches. We've seen conflict and war and pressure, and we've seen diplomacy. And only one of them has borne any fruit. The only one that has shown any results has been diplomacy. Under the pressure tactic, under the conflict, we've seen an increased Iranian nuclear program. We've seen increased Iranian hostile action in the region. We've seen conflict after conflict after conflict. Under diplomacy, we've seen the opposite. We've seen the Iranian nuclear program be contained. Now, through different diplomacy that the U.S. isn't engaged in, we're seeing a decreasing of Iranian and Saudi tensions in the region. There are opportunities that we have seen come to fruition through diplomacy, and we have seen the opposite under the other path. And so that gets to your question of what has the Biden administration approach been? The Biden administration approach has been to try diplomacy, but ultimately it has been unsuccessful for a couple different reasons. The first is they've essentially tried to do both. They've tried to keep the pressure up. They've tried to keep that track going. They didn't engage immediately out of the gate when they had an opportunity with diplomacy. Conditions on the ground change. The situation now is very complex because of the recent protests in Iran, the Ukrainian war, and Iranian support for Russia. Everything has gotten exponentially more complicated now. And so we've seen the diplomatic path largely struggle in this complex environment. But I think where the Biden administration deserves credit is that hasn't led them to abandon it. They have stayed engaged. They have stayed active. That's how you see agreements like the one bringing these Americans home come to fruition. Hopefully they will remain committed. Hopefully they will see that this complexity requires creative diplomacy, not the abandoning of diplomacy. And I think ultimately the verdict is not yet written on the Biden administration's approach towards Iran. Time's going to tell. They're still in office. Obviously, the president hopes he'll have a second term to continue pursuing these issues. But the verdict isn't in yet. And hopefully the president's going to choose to continue down the diplomatic path.
Mm-hmm. That brings me to my next question, that we are essentially entering election season here in the U.S. The first Republican primary debate is coming up actually later this month in August.
You're implying that we ever left election season in the U.S. Sorry, go ahead.
We never leave election season in the U.S. You're correct. But officially, in a way.
Yeah,
and,
of course.
We know that Iran is usually, especially for one party, is front and center when it comes to these debates, to the media fights. How much do you think this deal could be seen as a prelude to more understandings, as they want to call it, or agreements? I think there's a reluctance of calling it an actual deal like the JCPOA was, mm-hmm. pages and pages on paper. But do you see this as a de-escalation step towards more, or are we just too close into election season for the president and the administration, at least in this term, to be doing anything more on Iran? And then I want to ask you about a potential second term later. But let's talk about the remaining of this term. As you said, the verdict is not out yet.
Sure. I mean, I think the good news here is I don't think the Biden administration is pursuing this out of any sort of electoral politics calculus. I think mm-hmm. they're doing what they think good policy is. And I think because of that, they're going to continue to pursue what they think the right thing to do is. And in this case, that's hopefully more continued diplomacy. As to whether this will become an electoral issue, I'm incredibly skeptical. Look, we've seen Republicans for years try to make an issue out of Democratic support for the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear agreement under Barack Obama. It has been a spectacular failure. Not a single Democrat has lost an election because of their support for the JCPOA. It is not an electoral issue. It has never gained traction. There is a handful of wealthy mega donors on the GOP side who would really like it to be an electoral issue. And for whatever reason, the Republicans continue to run ads after taking that money on the issue. But time and time again, it's proved that those electoral ads are completely useless. They don't do anything to move the American public. And it's just not an issue. It's just not an electoral issue. Look, at the end of the day, that's because Americans are solidly down on the side of avoiding a war with Iran and pursuing diplomacy with Iran. I think where political prognosticators get it wrong is that they think the American public can be convinced that diplomacy isn't going to succeed or that it's unlikely to succeed. That's not why the American public supports diplomacy with Iran. The American public is actually incredibly sophisticated on this. When you look at polling, what you see in poll after poll after poll is the American public doesn't necessarily think diplomacy is going to work. They have a lot of decades-long animosity towards the Iranian regime. They do not think that diplomacy is likely to achieve significant results, but they still support diplomacy. Because at the end of the day, they recognize that the alternative to diplomacy is ultimately war. And the last thing the American public wants is another war of choice in the Middle East. They are committed to avoiding that. And they recognize that the path to avoiding that is continued diplomacy. And so they continue to reward politicians who pursue that. And I think it's that simple.
Mm-hmm. And what about a potential second term? We know that historically, the second term is the time for legacy building on the first term. You still have an eye on your second election coming up. As you said, the administration is not necessarily doing this for electoral purposes. In fact, the opposite. But if Joe Biden wins the presidency again and the second term comes, and looking back at the time when he was vice president with President Obama, so we know that negotiations did start, or he was eager in the first round, but the JCPOA and the actual deal and the chunk of the process didn't happen until his second term. Do you think a second Biden presidency, a second term of Joe Biden, would be we'll see essentially more of this diplomatic engagement and the escalation with Iran?
I think it's hard to say. Look, I think that the president and his team is generally committed to diplomacy and is likely to continue diplomacy. But we're in a very different place than we were in 2013, 2014, 2015 in terms of other issues on the international agenda. You know, I think we all hope that the war in Ukraine will be long over by 2025. But the reality is we don't know. We don't know what that will be. We don't. We do know that the U.S. and China and their relations will be a dominant feature of our foreign policy at that point. We don't know who will be in charge in Iran. That's another key factor here. You know, one of the differences between Obama's first term and Obama's second term and the diplomatic success and outreach certainly has to do with the differences in President Ahmadinejad versus President Rouhani. You know, obviously there's talk of the Ayatollah's health, the supreme leader, and kind of where he may be. So it's a complicated issue. There's diplomacy is complex. These kinds of things are always multi-causal. Anyone who ever looks at these issues and tells you this one thing made everything else happen and there was no other factor involved, they're just lying to you. That's not the way it works. It's not the way world events work. It's not the way diplomacy works. There's always a multitude of factors, and it can be difficult to prognosticate now about what the future is going to hold because it's hard to know how those factors will all play out. That said, we do know what the alternative is. We do know that if there is military conflict between the U.S. and Iran, it makes any diplomatic agreement much harder to achieve. The conflicts for the consequences for humans in terms of people in Iran, people in the region, U.S. men and women in uniform could be devastating. And so, you know, the alternative is a really bad, really dangerous world. And we're inching closer to that. We don't know what the future will hold, but we're seeing signs that should be worrying to people about Iranian activities, about the U.S. Troops going to the region, and talk of armed personnel on commercial ships. There is a lot of tension building in the region. I think that there will be a desire to decrease and relieve that tension, but the higher that tension builds, the harder it is to relieve. And when you have that much fuel sitting around, it only takes a spark for a major fire to erupt.
Mm-hmm. Let's also talk about the administration's policy towards the region as overall, as you also mentioned. We know President Biden or candidate Biden had promised to, for example, make Saudi Arabia pay the price or turn them into a pariah. The policy seems to be very different from that rhetoric now. There seemed to be a U.S. moving towards the path of disengaging from the region, paying more attention to the East and moving away from Middle East. That hasn't really happened. The administration seems to be focusing a lot on the Abraham Accords, making that one of the priorities of their policy towards the Middle East. And all of this also relates back to their Iran policy and how they deal or engage with some of these rivals in the regions. Talk about your assessment of their overall Middle East policy, where it looked like it may be going and where it actually ended up.
I think it's a great question. Look, I think that if we're being honest, that the U.S. relationship towards Saudi Arabia is one of the areas we've been disappointed in Joe Biden as president. Many of us were heartened to hear as candidate Joe Biden say that he was going to make Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman into an international pariah. That obviously hasn't happened. That hasn't happened despite not just the horrific murder of Jamal Khashoggi, but also repeated human rights abuses in Yemen, repeated human rights and abuses of individuals in Saudi Arabia, and complicated and complex problems that we continue to see in the region. Look, Washington needs to change its understanding of how it approaches Saudi Arabia, the UAE, the Gulf region in general. This is not relationships where the U.S. needs these countries to the level that these countries need the U.S. And the U.S. needs to be behaving more with that understanding. We need to be putting into practice our rhetoric about human rights being at the core of our foreign policy, and that when countries like Saudi Arabia and the UAE are repeated abusers of human rights using American-made military weapons, they need to stop receiving that hardware. This is not about, you know, kind of boosting U.S. arms sales. This should be about centering human rights in our foreign policy and living up to that, and no longer continuing to provide these regimes with the weapons that they are using to commit these abuses. So we've been disappointed about this. The administration would likely come back and say it's complicated. There's lots of talk in Washington about Saudi and UAE turning towards China, and this all gets wrapped up in the U.S.-China relationship. But at the end of the day, if we are going to have a foreign policy that genuinely centers human rights, then we need to be serious about that, and we need to make that core to how we navigate these relationships. That's part of it. Look, I will also say as a progressive that we need to be thinking about climate change, and we need to be thinking about the role that climate change is playing in our foreign policy. We're talking about essentially large petrochemical companies when we're talking about Saudi Arabia and the UAE. And the U.S. needs to not be living in a 20th century mindset of how we keep kind of oil and gas flowing, but in a 21st century mindset about how we move the world beyond fossil fuels. And one of the benefits of that is that these autocracies, these dictatorships that have at their heads these monarchies, these ruling families who control vast sums of money through oil and natural gas, that they lose that power, that they can no longer commit these kinds of abuses. They can no longer drive the kind of corruption that we're seeing. We need to have honest reckonings about this in our foreign policy. This goes way beyond whether Joe Biden's been kind of good or bad on these issues. It gets to a much deeper fundamental shift that Washington needs to have in how it thinks about its foreign policy. And so we're really focused on that. We'd like to have that conversation. And it's long past time that Washington begins to do that.
Well, on that note, Stephen, I want to thank you for joining the Iran podcast.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure. Happy to be back anytime.
It was a pleasure to have you. That was Stephen Miles, president of Win Without War, an organization that's been working for a more peaceful and progressive U.S. foreign policy for over two decades. And thank you for listening to the Iran podcast. You can find us on all major podcast apps, so please subscribe and also leave a review and rating for us. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're at Iran Podcast. I'm your host, Negar Mortazavi, and until next time, goodbye.